Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back. Or if you're new here, hi, welcome, I'm Georgia. On my platforms here on the internet, I tend to focus on unsolved true crime, missing people, unidentified people, cold murder cases. But there is an episode I've wanted to make for a really long time, and that's an episode about the News of the World hacking scandal, a scandal that rocked Britain 10 plus years ago when the information really came out to the public. It was a really dark period in British tabloid history. I say that like tabloids aren't still awful to this very day, but I feel like in order to really tell the story of that hacking scandal, to drill in just truly how lacking in morals that was, there's a whole other story that I really need to tell first, and that is the story of schoolgirl Millie Dowler, a case that did eventually get solved after many, many years of hard investigation, which I suppose is a testament to not giving up on a case, to keeping the name out there to the public. The treatment of the Dowler family in the aftermath of their daughter's murder was just truly horrific, both by the media and the criminal justice system. They deserved so much better than they got, and their treatment did lead to a kind of overhaul of how families are treated when dealing with something like this. Amanda Jane Dowler was known as Millie to everyone. She was born on the 25th of June 1988 in Walton-on-Thames in Surrey, here in the UK, to her parents Bob and Sally. She was the younger of two daughters to the couple, with her older sister Gemma being one of her absolute best friends. I mean, although the pair did have their own separate bedrooms, in the weeks leading up to Millie's murder, her and Gemma were actually sharing one room, so they could just stay up late into the night and eat midnight feasts of the sweets that they hid away. They were very typical sisters, but they were very close. In the Crime Watch special, Taken, the Millie Dowler story, Gemma described her sister as vivacious, friendly, approachable. She always had this twinkle in her eye. Millie was the kind of person that everyone wanted to be friends with. Friends in the documentary described her as sweet, kind and generous. She would do anything to brighten someone's day if she knew that they were sad. Her friends also said that she was a fantastic musician and very much a people person. She could chat your ear off, and she just wanted to be liked by everyone. I mean, don't we all? On the day of Thursday, the 21st of March 2002, Millie was 13 years old, and she'd been at her school in Weybridge, Heathside School. Nothing much really exciting happened at school that day, except her and her friend Danielle had a very much overdue catch-up. They made plans to walk to the train station together after school so they could chat on the way home. Millie caught the train to and from school every day, as a lot of kids in the UK do. So she left school that afternoon at 3:05 p.m. and her and Danielle walked to the train station together as they'd planned. Danielle said that she was in a very playful, fun mood that day as always, and when they reached the Walton-on-Thames stop where Danielle usually got off, they weren't done catching up just yet. So Danielle invites Millie to go to the cafe at the train station so they could grab some chips and carry on chatting, to which Millie very much agreed. Millie usually got off the train just one stop later, but it wasn't too long a walk for her to get back from the Walton-on-Thames stop, so it wasn't too much of a big deal. I got the impression this is something that Millie did fairly often. Over a portion of chips, they sat and chatted about boys and school and all the usual things young teenage girls talk about. But Millie was a considerate kid. She needed to call her dad, who was working at home, to let him know that she was going to be home late so he didn't worry. But Millie was also apparently known for never having any credit on her phone, back in the times that everyone's phones were in this credit system rather than monthly contracts. She didn't have enough credit to call her dad, and I assume Danielle didn't either. So Millie asked some schoolboys who were also in the cafe, and I assume they knew from their school, to borrow one of their phones. She calls her dad, tells him that she's going to be home just a little bit later than usual because she stopped for chips, but don't worry, she will be home for dinner. The friends parted ways just after 4 p.m. when Danielle's sister turned up at the cafe to take her home. Millie planned to walk the rest of the way home on her own, to which Danielle checked that she was going to be okay. Millie just laughed and said of course she would be. She'd lived in this area her whole life, she walked this route very regularly, it was broad daylight, of course she was going to be fine. Millie heads off walking down Station Avenue, away from the train station and the cafe, where at 4:08 p.m. a friend of Gemma, Millie's older sister, spots her walking. The witness says that just 30 to 60 seconds later, the bus turned up, and she notes that once she was on board the bus, Millie was now nowhere to be seen, but the witness didn't really think much of it. I mean, why would she assume the worst? Maybe Millie just turned down a road, she didn't know. At 5 p.m, Gemma arrived home and asked their dad where Millie was. He said that he thought she would be picking her sister up, that they were together. And immediately, in that moment, the panic sets in. Gemma says that in that split second, they just had this awful, dark feeling that something bad had happened, that they were never going to see Millie again. I mean, it was entirely unlike her not to come home. Even when she was going to be just half an hour late, she called her dad to let him know. Around 7 p.m, with no sign of Millie, they called the police, who luckily took this case seriously from the very beginning. This would very quickly become one of Britain's biggest ever murder inquiries, with over 100 officers on it every day in those early days. It was clear to the authorities right off the bat that Millie wasn't a runaway risk. She wasn't really someone who would voluntarily leave her family, and there wasn't really anything to indicate that that was the case. Police knew very quickly that they were dealing with something quite serious here, and time was of the essence. If they were going to find Millie Dowler, they needed the public's help. Within hours, people living in Walton-on-Thames knew to be on the lookout for Millie, with police officers and helicopters searching fields, streets and rivers in the area. 8-year-old Sarah Payne, who I did an episode on just a couple of months ago, had been murdered under 2 years earlier, with the investigation here calling back to that. Detectives who had assisted in the investigation in Sarah's case were called in to help with Millie's. I mean, Roy Whiting being captured and charged with murder just 7 months after Sarah disappeared, although detectives had been very hot on his trail within just a day of her disappearance. They knew the same needed to be duplicated in Millie's case, but there was still a hope here that she could still be found alive. Just 2 days after her disappearance, Bob and Sally, Millie's parents, made a public TV appeal asking people to keep an eye out for their daughter, for any signs of her or her abductor. Millie became the front page of every newspaper, the lead story on every single news programme. The British media, in cases like this, is a double-edged sword. You need the media to get the story out there. Without it, no one's going to know to be keeping a lookout for Millie's face. You need to keep her name and face alive in the mind of the public. But this case is a very good study of when this media interest goes too far, when it oversteps and starts analysing every aspect of the family's life. This media attention at first for the Dowlers was a godsend, but soon they found themselves feeling like they were the ones on trial, their private lives no longer private. Imagine being in this situation, your daughter goes missing under the most horrific of circumstances, and then your entire life is broadcast to the whole country. It's just trauma piled on top of trauma. 1 week after Millie's disappearance, on the 28th of March 2002, Millie's story was featured and reconstructed on BBC's Crime Watch. Her parents also appeared on the programme and made another public appeal. Again, these reconstructions were vital to keep Millie in the public eye, to try and jog people's memories, especially locals to Walton-on-Thames. Anybody driving past, driving on Station Avenue at this time, was asked to come forward, even if they didn't think they'd seen anything. Pictures of Millie were circulated across the internet, at football matches and supermarkets. A £100,000 reward was offered for any news as to where she was. Will Young, who was fresh out of Pop Idol at this time and of whom Millie was a very big fan, even appealed for information before one of his gigs. Millie had been to a Pop Idol concert just the Tuesday before she disappeared. In the first 2 weeks of the investigation, the police knocked on all local doors and received over 4,000 calls from the public. There are at least 73 areas of the UK where Millie was apparently sighted on more than one occasion. There were sightings coming in from Fiji on the Isle of Wight ferry, and this was a huge job for the police. They had to sort of sift through every single lead that came in and decide what was worth further investigation, what should be prioritised. They didn't have the manpower to follow through on every single one. But for a long time, there really wasn't any movement in the investigation at all. They interviewed all the witnesses. They found that Millie was last seen by her sister's friend walking along Station Avenue at 4:08 p.m. But after that, there was nothing. She literally just vanished off the street in broad daylight. However, luckily for investigators, there actually were CCTV cameras that covered the majority of this road, Station Avenue. There were two rotating cameras on the side of the Bird's Eye Company building. But when police got access to this footage, they found something baffling. Millie just wasn't spotted walking along this road at all, which established that Millie must have vanished within just 50 yards of the station, the only part of the road the cameras didn't cover. But the day on which Millie disappeared was actually a very sunny and wet day, which did mean that the sun flare on the water on the camera blocked the view at certain points as the camera rotated. What if behind the flare there was important footage that they were missing? So the Surrey police actually turned to the FBI to help them work on the footage, to help them clear it up. This whole process took quite a few months, till eventually the FBI thought they'd found something. Behind a tree you could see a sports car that was pulled over, with a figure standing next to the car, somebody kind of leaning over and talking to someone inside. The figure stands next to the car for between 42 and 84 seconds because the exact time was unclear because of the rotation of the camera, and this footage was analysed within an inch of its life, the FBI trying to figure out how tall this person was, what they were wearing, saying that in the end this was a 50-50 chance as to it being Millie. With this information now back in the hands of the Surrey police, they called in a car expert who determined that the sports car in question was a rare style of Mazda, of which only 5,000 had been sold in the UK, and this at the time was considered to be a huge breakthrough in the case. I mean, if this car had something to do with Millie's disappearance, then it wasn't going to be hard to track down the driver. And that's what the police started with, making a public appeal for the driver of this car to come forward. And it turns out they did, the very same day this information was released to the public. It turns out this was actually just a mum and her son. It was completely innocent. The pair were going to an estate agent to view a property. This was the first big lead the investigators had found in this investigation, and it turned out to be a dead end. An article I found about this in The Guardian is dated Friday the 13th September 2002, by which point 1,850 statements had been taken, 5,500 calls had been made from the public, and 3,500 house-to-house inquiries had been made. Little did investigators know that just 5 days later, on the 18th September 2002, Millie's remains would be found by a couple out foraging for mushrooms in Yateley Heath Woods in Yateley in Hampshire. This was just under 6 months after she disappeared. When the couple discovered this body in the woods, they headed straight to the police station to report what they'd found, and they mentioned at the time that they thought it was Millie. This was how big this investigation was, how much it was in the media. A couple find a body and immediately assume that it must be Millie. Investigators rushed to the area, and it was indeed confirmed just 24 hours later that these remains were those of Millie Dowler, the match made via dental records. But due to the level of decomposition, she had been there all summer, it wasn't visually obvious who this was. It did have to be done through the dentals. Her body was found completely nude, and no item that she had on her at the time of her disappearance, so her phone, her clothes, school bag, have ever been found. Although it was clear to police already that Millie had likely been murdered, the discovery of her body meant this case was now officially a murder inquiry. A post-mortem was carried out, but again, due to the level of decomposition, it wasn't really able to provide any answers as to how she died. answers about that wouldn't come for many, many years. But how her body was found, nude and laid on top of the ground, made it very clear that this wasn't a natural death. So they brought in experts to take a look at the wooded area, pollen and foliage experts to be exact. They analysed the natural growth in the area to determine exactly how long the body had been there for. Obviously, little would have been able to grow under the body as long as it was there, so looking at what had grown around her versus under her would provide a fairly accurate timeline. The experts determined that Millie's body had been there since the week she went missing, since March. Millie's body being found after so many months, after so much anguish, provided a touch of closure for the Dowlers, who had been dealing with the hardest time of their lives.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I can't imagine living through something like this with the media watching like hawks. And with Millie being found, that wasn't about to end. Again, the media is a double-edged sword. It was now vital that the publications and the public didn't lose interest in the case now that Millie had been found, after everyone had been looking out for her for so many months. Now instead, they needed to be engaged to help search for the killer. At the later trial, many years later, it would come out that the police really messed up around this time, in that they focused a lot of their time and effort on Millie's father, Bob Dowler, as a suspect. Of course, I do understand that you do need to look closely at family in cases like this. I do know that often loved ones are involved, but it does seem like in the absence of any other good suspects, they just focused in on the only potential one they had, and that was Bob. In searching the house, investigators had come across a number of notes and poems that Millie had written over the previous weeks and months, in which she spoke about drama she had with her dad and just generally with her life. It was all very dramatic in the way that it can only be with a 13-year-old girl. The notes detailed how Millie thought she wasn't pretty or fit, that she was just totally shit, whilst her sister was the pretty and intelligent one. One note was interpreted as maybe being a potential suicide note or a runaway note, with Millie writing about how by the time they found this letter, she would be gone. Obviously, Millie never followed through on anything that she threatened. Being a teenage girl myself, once upon a time, I can vouch that hormones make you a little bit crazy, a little bit overdramatic. I do understand that police had to take the suicide or runaway note very seriously in the early days of the investigation, but it was still a missing persons inquiry in those early days, so it would have been treated similarly either way. Like, whether Millie had run away or not, they still had to find her. It was more after she'd been murdered, the stuff about her dad caused delay in the investigation, with one of Millie's notes reading, "Jess is a true friend, she is the best. Jess helped me the most with this whole dad thing." Bob said he didn't know exactly what caused her to write this, he didn't really know what the dad thing was, but Millie had apparently come across a pornographic magazine in his bedside drawer previously, and this had upset her quite deeply. I mean, no one wants to think of their parents as sexual beings, especially for a 13-year-old girl. I can imagine this would have been quite traumatising. Because of the note, the police zoned in on him, with Bob saying at the later trial this concerned him because he knew that he hadn't done anything. And if they were focusing on him, they weren't focusing on who had actually taken his daughter. The Surrey police later apologised if their attention on Bob caused them to miss other investigative opportunities, but that was about all they said. For 20 months, all lines of investigation would just result in dead ends, but then Surrey police received a phone call from their colleagues over at the Met Police in London. An officer who used to work with Surrey Police but had recently transferred, a man called DCI Sutton, was investigating a series of offences in the London area, the attacks and even murders of young women. He said that they had a pretty good suspect in their investigation, but as he was looking at this suspect's profile, he noticed that one of his previous addresses was 24 Collingwood Place in Walton-on-Thames, the front door of Collingwood Place being less than 100 yards from where Millie was last seen. According to the Crime Watch documentary, the senior investigating officer who took this call said that as he heard this, the hairs on the back of his neck stood up. He knew straight away that this was going to be their first real breakthrough in Millie's case. The suspect in question was a man called Levi Belfield, who at this point was in his 30s and had been committing crimes since he was a young teenager, the crime slowly becoming more and more violent over the years. Belfield had left school at age 16 and he did train as a mechanic, but instead of pursuing that as a career, he instead became a doorman and also set up his own private car clamping business as well. The psychology of this has been analysed a lot over the years, but it's very clear that Belfield leant towards jobs that gave him a feeling of power, being able to tell others what to do, to hold power over others. He had this very large physical presence, which came in very handy for door work for obvious reasons, but also nobody's going to argue with a man of his stature when it comes to car clamping. By his 30s, Belfield had a long list of convictions, including drug offences, possession of weapons, violent assaults, and threats to kill, amongst many other things. This was undeniably a very violent man, and previous partners of his confirmed as much, having lived lives controlled by domestic violence, controlled by him. He would punch, bite, kick, burn them with cigarettes. Exes said that he very clearly saw women as objects that he needed to control, and he was willing to use extreme violence in order to get what he wanted. In his eyes, women were expendable, they were less than human. His exes weren't allowed to answer the phone, open the door, even open their post without him watching over their shoulder. So Levi Belfield, living just yards away from where Millie was taken, should have been a clear suspect when it came to her murder. How did they miss it? We know that police did 3,500 house-to-house inquiries in the investigation, and number 24 Collingwood Place was knocked on 11 times by police over the weeks after she disappeared. But no one ever answered the door. If the police were following regulations, the officers should have contacted the lettings agency to find out who was living there at the time. But they never did. I mean, otherwise they would have had Levi Belfield's name a lot quicker than 20 months after Millie's discovery. I mean, it was now 2004-2005, and by this time he was already suspected in two other murders in southwest London and a further 30 assaults in the area. Both the murders he was now a suspect in, so Marcia McDonald in February 2003 and Amélie de la Grange in August 2004, obviously happened after Millie's death. Could they have been avoided? An 18-year-old girl called Kate Sheedy was also attacked, but against all the odds, she survived. 19-year-old Marcia McDonald was on her gap year when her path crossed with Levi Belfield. She was on her gap year, like I said, with plans to travel to Australia before going off to university, and at this time she was just living her best life. She was a talented netball player and violinist, and she was described as quiet and hardworking. At 12:18 a.m. on the 4th of February 2003, she got off the H22 bus in Priory Road in Hampton after going to the cinema with her friends, and from there she began the very short walk back to her home on the same road. Belfield came up to her and attacked, likely using a lump hammer as his weapon. Marcia was found to have suffered three separate and heavy impacts on her head, with associated fractures and severe brain injury. The attack was likely so quick that she didn't even have time to raise her arms to protect herself. She'd soon be found by neighbours lying on the pavement, who quickly got her to hospital, where she spent 2 days before passing away. Kate Sheedy was 18 years old on the 28th of May 2004, and she was celebrating her final day at school where she'd been head girl, just with some friends at the local pub. She caught the bus home to Isleworth on her own, and as she was walking back, she noticed a car parked up at the side of the road, and it just gave her a bad feeling. The engine was running, but no lights were on, and it felt weird, so she decided to cross the road. And this is a message for all women to follow their instincts. Your gut is usually right when things feel off. Follow your gut. As Kate crossed the road, the car flashed its lights and turned the engine on, and before she knew what was happening, the car had driven into her and then reversed again over her body lying on the ground. It was undeniably a deliberate attack. Amazingly, Kate managed to crawl to help and called the police. She was rushed to hospital, and according to The Independent, she suffered a ruptured liver, punctured lung, broken ribs, and broken collarbone. Against all the odds, she survived and made a full recovery, but she did have to miss her A-levels the following month. Luckily for police, Kate had paid close attention to the car that hit her. It was a white people carrier with blacked out windows and a broken passenger side wing mirror. Amélie de la Grange was 22 years old from a small village in northern France, and she'd moved to the UK in 2002 in the hope of improving her English. She originally moved to Manchester before settling in London in April 2004. She moved into a bedsit near Twickenham Green and she worked at a bakery in Richmond. Her parents described her as happy, smiling and loving, with her boyfriend backing up this smiling sentiment. He said he first noticed her working in the cafe because she was always smiling. Amélie was actually meant to be moving back to France that year, but she was having such a good time in London that she told her family that she did intend to extend her stay. On the night of Thursday, August 19th, 2004, she'd gone for a drink with friends in Twickenham before catching the 267 bus back home alone. It was actually quite a short journey and Amélie ended up missing her stop and ended up getting off at Fulwell instead of her usual stop. But this wasn't too much of an issue, it just meant that she'd have to walk back down the road and then cross Twickenham Green in the dark. Halfway across the green, her killer, Levi Belfield, approached her and hit her round the back of the head with a blunt weapon, again very likely a hammer. Amélie was found unconscious at 10:30 p.m. and she was taken to hospital where she would sadly die. In the aftermath of Amélie's murder, a police station was set up on Twickenham Green and they received a lot of information from locals about violent men in the area. And one of the names that came up was that of Levi Belfield, so he was brought in for questioning. The officers who first questioned him said that he was a proper lad, a proper geezer kind of guy, but he had this jovial air about him, acting like he wanted to be your friend. Something that's quite striking when you listen to interviews with Belfield is that his voice just doesn't match this imposing figure that he has. He's actually quite soft-spoken. But don't let this fool you. This is a man who is domineering, overpowering, controlling and possessive. A man who doesn't see women as human beings. A man who believes their property to be controlled. He confessed to a partner at one point that he hated women, that at night he would go out and literally hunt them down. He lived near a train station at the time, to which some people would have to walk down a dark alleyway to reach the main road. He would wait there, in the dark, in this alleyway, for a lone woman to pass him. And when they didn't, apparently he'd get very angry and take it out on his partner who he was living with at the time. Levi Belfield was looking like quite a good suspect for the murder of Amélie. But remember how Kate Sheedy had been able to describe the car her attacker was driving? Well, it turns out that matched the description of the car Belfield was driving at the time, right down to the broken wing mirror. CCTV footage from the night of Kate's attack showed that not only was her description of this car correct, but this car had followed the bus before pulling over after Kate got off, and then it sped away after the attack. This was targeted. Belfield was following the bus specifically to attack someone. So investigators also took a look at the CCTV of the buses Amélie and Marsha were on before they got murdered. Again, in both cases, there were vehicles seen following the buses. Both makes of those vehicles could be linked to Belfield. This seemed like a slam dunk for the investigators. By the end of 2004, Met Police had enough compelling evidence to start charging him. So on the 22nd November 2004, he was arrested on suspicion of the murder of Amélie. 3 days later, he was charged with 3 counts of rape. On the 9th of December 2004, he was charged with assaulting a woman. In early 2006, he was then rearrested and charged with Amélie's murder, with her actual murder, not just on suspicion this time, along with the attempted murder of Kate Sheedy and another attempted murder of a woman called Irma Dragoshi. Irma was another woman who'd been attacked at a bus stop in December 2003. In May 2006, he's also charged with the murder of Marsha. By this point, Belfield had already been interviewed for the first time about Millie's murder, that was in July 2005. In the interview, he was asked outright if he had anything to do with the kidnap and murder of Millie Dowler. To every question he was asked, he simply replied, "No comment." However, at no point did he protest his innocence or give any explanation as to where he actually was on the day Millie disappeared. At one stage in the interview, he seemed to start to get very flustered and started sweating heavily, having to remove his jumper and sort of he started rocking back on his chair. However, at this point, all the evidence they had against him in Millie's case was purely circumstantial. The fact that he lived so close to where Millie went missing, his criminal history, the fact that he wouldn't give an alibi. Other than that, they really didn't have anything. They just had to keep investigating, had to keep chugging away. So they started looking into every aspect of his life, which included talking to his girlfriend at the time Millie went missing, which is a woman called Emma Mills. Emma confirmed that in 2002, the pair lived in her Collingwood Place flat with their children. But at the time Millie went missing, they were actually house-sitting somewhere else. So the Collingwood Place flat was empty at this time. But Emma did say that on the day in question, she didn't know where Belfield was. He disappeared for many hours and only arrived home around 10-11pm in what she believed were different clothes than what he'd been wearing when he left that morning. When he got home, the pair went to bed, but he woke up around 3-4am saying that he wanted to lie in and was going back to Collingwood Place and was taking the dog with him. A witness who was actually out searching for Millie that next morning would later say that around 5am, he saw someone of Belfield's description with a dog at Collingwood Place. And then, inexplicably, Emma said the very next day, Belfield moved them out of the flat, despite there being 2 months left on the tenancy agreement. He wanted them to move back to a squat I think they'd previously lived in, despite it being in terrible condition. It wasn't suitable at all for children, there was no kitchen floor, no furniture, they had to sleep on sofa cushions on the floor. Emma didn't want to do this, she was very confused by the choice, but what Belfield said, you did. Remember, he was abusive, controlling, overpowering. She wouldn't have had the strength to say no to him, so they moved out. Emma has said that in hindsight, there were several strange things that were going on at this time, but she never connected anything to Millie. I don't think you ever suspect the person you're in a relationship with to be a child killer.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
She said that she noticed that several of their items, such as their bed sheets, went missing. Belfield said that the dog had messed on them, so he had to throw them away, which wasn't something their dog would generally do. Emma didn't really believe him and questioned him about this very strange behaviour, asked him where he'd been. In her mind, he had to be having an affair, which is why she was so shocked when Belfield replied, "What, do you think I've done Millie?" She said she was disgusted with him for even joking about something like that. It was so inconceivable to her that it could be true, that this statement was just brushed off as a very crude joke. Looking back, it seems like Belfield really freaked out after Millie's abduction and murder. I don't think he ever expected the amount of media attention that came, the amount of intense investigation that came on the back of Millie's death. He was making stupid moves, and even then, he didn't get caught, and that probably bolstered his ego and made him more confident to go on to attack Marcia and Emily and Kate and more. And Emma wasn't the only ex of Belfield's that investigators spoke to. They also spoke to a woman called Joanna, who had dealt with his control for many years. And this is where my own sort of story, own experience intersects with this story. One of those very bleak reminders that you're never that far removed from true crime, from tragedy. And I don't say this to make this story about me, it's not about me. I just say it to remind us all that we're only a couple of degrees removed, but all interconnected. Joanna was a horse rider and she regularly competed when she was younger, show jumping at local horse shows. On a couple of occasions, Joanna took her then boyfriend Levi Belfield with her to Yateley Horse Show, a horse show that I've personally attended with my family a number of times. My girlfriend also used to attend that horse show before it shut down, telling fond stories of how the courses would always be underbuilt so it was very easy to qualify for the next classes. This is a field, an area that me and my loved ones, being horse people, have spent a lot of hours in over the years before the show was shut down. Yateley is an area that I personally know quite well. I highly doubt that I ever spent time at Yateley Show when Belfield was actually there. This was likely back in the 90s and my family would have been there sort of 2008, 2009 onwards. But the thought of this man at a horse show surrounded by teenage and preteen girls is enough to make your blood turn cold. I've known about the Millie Dowler case, well, since I was 8 years old, since it happened in 2002. I think everyone in the UK knows the face and name of Millie Dowler. We all know her story. But until I researched this video, I had no idea that it kind of hit so close to home for me, quite literally. Again, it's just a reminder of how we're all so closely linked, how everyone is interconnected, especially in a place like the UK. Joanna told police that her and Belfield used to take walks around this area in Yateley, through the woodland surrounding the show field, and police asked her to walk this route with them, and unknowingly, she took them right to the clearing where Millie's body had been found by the mushroom foragers. Belfield had clearly drawn on his past experiences, his past knowledge of this woodland when disposing of her body. The evidence was mounting up against him with each new day. Every new thing the police learned was just another puzzle piece added to the picture. But what they really needed to do was prove that Belfield was on Station Avenue at the time that Millie was taken. Although the evidence was indeed mounting up, it was all still circumstantial. For him to be charged, there had to be a lot of circumstantial evidence, too much to deny, or something forensic. So investigators turned back to Emma Mills and spoke to her at length, asking her about the car that Belfield was driving at the time of Millie's disappearance. His car had linked him to the case in London, why not this one? Emma told them that at the time they had a red Daewoo Nexia. So investigators went back to the Bird's Eye CCTV to see if they could spot that specific vehicle on the footage around the time Millie went missing, and bingo. The car was spotted turning onto Station Avenue at 4:33 p.m. from Copenhagen Way. Copenhagen Way led directly to Collingwood Place. This was just 25 minutes after Millie had last been seen. Police knew that if they had any chance of finding any forensic evidence in this case, then they needed that car. But turns out, Belfield had reported the car as stolen just 8 days after Millie disappeared. Now, no one genuinely believed the car had been stolen, but despite exhaustive searches, it's never been found to this day. They even went as far as searching bodies of water to see if it had been submerged, and there was just nothing. There were public appeals run for any information about the whereabouts of this car, asking anyone if they had seen it or a car of a similar description. And what came off the back of this is something no one expected. Another girl reporting an altercation, a meeting with Levi Belfield. On the 20th of March 2002, so just the day before Millie vanished, 11-year-old Rachel Cowles had finished school around 3:15 p.m. She said a man in a red car pulled up next to her as she was walking home and he introduced himself as her new neighbour. Did she want to lift home? Luckily, Rachel knew her neighbours, she was very switched on and knew instantly not to trust this man, so she just carried on walking a bit faster and ignored him. Rachel, it turns out, bore an uncanny resemblance to Millie Dowler. Is it possible that after Rachel turned Belfield down, he decided not to give the next girl a choice, to just grab her? The incident was reported to police the very same day, with Rachel describing the man as 30 to 40 years old with a round face, driving a red hatchback with two children's car seats in the back. Emma confirmed that this matched the description of their car. Although Rachel's incident happened just the day before Millie disappeared, it hadn't filtered through to the incident room in time. The significance of this event, the significance of the red car, wasn't known until Emma Mills was spoken to in 2005, which is too many years later. I can only hope that all of this led to a deeper look at the systems within the police, because this should have been picked up on at the time. You've got two very similar incidents involving similar looking preteen teen girls in the similar area in the space of 24 hours. This should have been picked up on, and it wasn't. With all this evidence building up against him, the Crown Prosecution Service asked for further information in Millie's case before Belfield could be charged. Undeniably, there was already a lot of evidence against him, but they didn't want to take any chances this could fall through, especially because it's all circumstantial. If they were going to get the guy, they were going to get the guy. All of this was being found out around 2005, at the same time with a very heavy investigation in the Met Police's case against him for the assaults and murders there. It wasn't until the 25th of February 2018 that Surrey police were able to publicly confirm that Levi Belfield was their prime suspect in Millie's murder and that they wished to question him once again. By this point, Belfield had been charged for the two murders and attempted murder and was already in prison for good, having been handed down 3 life terms never to be released. But this wasn't enough. The country needed solid answers in Millie's case. It wasn't enough to think that her killer was probably already behind bars. The country as a whole needed closure. The Dowlers needed closure. Belfield had been charged with 2 murders. 3 would make him a serial killer. But as I've said, this case has always been circumstantial. They've never had any forensic evidence to link him. Instead, investigators had to prove that he was the only person that could have done this, meaning that to charge him, they had to rule out all other possibilities. And that's not an easy thing to do. So the investigators continued working, continued plugging away on the bird's eye CCTV, the images sent over to forensic imagery expert who confirmed once and for all that Millie had never walked all the way down Station Avenue. With the way the cameras sort of rotated, there was a chance before that Millie had sort of crossed the road then walked down the other side. It would have been harder to see her, and maybe as she walked and the camera rotated, it could have just missed her as she walked behind cars and trees. The imagery expert confirmed that whilst this was technically possible, she would have had to have been running incredibly fast and sort of hiding from the cameras intentionally to not be seen at all. And why would she have done that? Realistically, this wasn't going to be the case. So it was determined that Millie had to have been abducted on that road, and she had to have been abducted within just yards of the station and Belfield's flat. Because basically Collingwood Place had this little cut through, a little alleyway type thing that connected it to the main road. If you were driving there, you had to drive down Station Avenue, drive down Copenhagen, and then sort of turn onto Collingwood. But if you were walking, you could just cut through this little alleyway straight onto the main road. If Millie had been grabbed and dragged into this little alleyway type thing, the camera never would have seen her. And this seemed to be the last evidence they needed. Detectives were now confident they could prove that Belfield had to be the killer here. He had to be the only person. They determined that Millie left the station that day and started her walk down Station Avenue. Although she could have continued walking down the path she was on, for some reason still unknown, she decided to cross the road and walk down the other side, the side furthest from the bird's eye camera. Maybe she just wanted to spice her walk up. I know when I was walking to and from school sometimes, I'd walk down the other side of the road just for something a little bit different. Little did Millie know, as she crossed the road that day, there was a predator hiding behind the tall bushes that separated Station Avenue from Collingwood Place, bushes that could very easily hide a full-grown man. As Millie walked past, Belfield grabbed her and pulled her into the bushes, dragging her to his flat in Collingwood. For a very long time, detectives believed that it was in this flat where Millie was killed, because Belfield didn't actually talk for a very long time. It seems to be just sheer luck, or sheer bad luck I should say, that nobody on the main road, not a single neighbour, spotted Belfield as he dragged this girl. Just 25 minutes later at 4:33 p.m, he leaves in the red car. Again, for a long time it was thought that Millie was left in the flat and he was alone in the car, but I'll detail Belfield's own eventual confession later in this episode. At this point, investigators are working under the assumption that Belfield left the flat alone. Phone records show that at this point he headed towards West Drayton, where Emma was house-sitting, but she said that he didn't arrive there until about 11 p.m. At the time of the investigation, he would not say where he'd been in those lost hours. At 5 a.m. the next morning, he returns back to Collingwood Place, where it was believed that he went to move Millie's body because Emma was due to go back home. It was thought that this is when he drove to Yateley and dumped her body in Yateley Heath Wood, which was 24 miles away. Belfield spends the next week covering his tracks, destroying any evidence that could link him to Millie. And he was clearly successful at destroying the forensic evidence, because to this day, there still isn't any. Finally, on the 30th of March 2010, 8 years after Millie's death, Levi Belfield was charged with her abduction and murder. Surrey police didn't have any idea that the Crown Prosecution Service had finally decided to pursue these charges until they announced it publicly. The trial began on the 10th of May 2011 at the Central Criminal Court and lasted until the 23rd of June that same year. The Crown had a very strong circumstantial case here, so the defence had sort of two possibilities for their approach. The defence either had to argue that Belfield was not responsible for Millie's murder, but somebody with a very similar MO, considering he'd already been found guilty of two very similar murders, who also just happened to be in this area, had been the one responsible. Or they could argue that Millie was not abducted, that she chose to run away and met her death in any other way at an unknown location. Maybe she'd ended her own life. They decided to argue the latter. And that's where Millie's dramatic notes and poems are featured in the trial, where her father was interrogated about his relationship with his own daughter. The Dowler family were cross-examined about their personal life, about how Millie was incredibly unhappy in the months leading up to her disappearance. Can you imagine how hard that is to hear as a parent that your daughter was unhappy before she died in such an awful way? Both Sally and Bob sobbed their way through the testimony. They later suggested that had they known how they were going to be treated in court, at their own daughter's murder trial being treated worse than the person on trial, that they would have maybe refused to testify and possibly risk Belfield's acquittal. He was already in prison for life, it's not like he was going to be able to hurt anyone else. Following the trial, this actually prompted the victim's commissioner, called Louise Casey, to issue a review into the needs of families bereaved by homicide, in which he made a number of recommendations for bereaved families' rights in the criminal justice system. Some of these recommendations included police updates at every stage of the investigation, the right to information, the introduction of a direction about the needs and treatment of bereaved families in court. It's crazy to think that these things weren't already in place. In response, Keir Starmer, who was actually the Director of Public Prosecutions at the time, announced that CPS was increasing its services to bereaved families. So at least something came out of this, I suppose.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
However, there has always been question around whether in a criminal trial such as this one, how much should personal feelings come into play? This was hard on the Dowlers for sure, but should niceness come at the cost of someone's right to a decent defence? To what extent can trial processes be changed to protect the victims and witnesses at the risk of a criminal getting released? The accused person's right to a fair trial will always be paramount. It's kind of the basis of the justice system as it stands. But the Dowlers were up on this stand being treated like criminals when really they were looking at the criminal, the person responsible for their daughter's death, who wasn't being treated anywhere near as badly. On the 23rd of June 2011, Levi Belfield was found guilty of the murder of Millie Dowler with a unanimous decision from the jury, and he was sentenced to life in prison the following day. The judge again imposed a whole life order. Belfield was also being tried on the other charge of the attempted abduction of Rachel Cowles, but after newspapers were deemed to have published prejudiced material, this charge had to be abandoned, although it did remain on his file. Levi Belfield is one of under 100 people in the UK who have been given life, meaning life, as in no possibility of parole, never seeing the streets again. In the weeks after the trial, distressing news came out about the News of the World hacking scandal and about how an investigator working for the tabloid allegedly hacked into Millie's phone in the weeks after she was abducted. I've actually been researching that episode for longer than I've been researching this one, but I realised that if I wanted people to really understand the depravity of what the tabloid did, what the News of the World did, then I do need to tell the story of Millie Dowler first. In a really brief synopsis, the phone hacking scandal was just that. The News of the World tabloid was hiring private investigators to hack into the voicemails of any number of people. Celebrities, lawyers, royals, even dead schoolgirls apparently, all for the sake of journalism. On the 4th of July 2011, the Dowlers released a statement through their lawyer stating that the News of the World's actions were heinous and despicable, and that they were now pursuing a damages claim against the paper. Scotland Yard had also not long started a new inquiry into the phone hacking, and were believed to have found evidence about Millie's hacking in a collection of 11,000 pages of notes kept by a PI called Glenn Mulcair, who by this point had already been jailed for hacking. In the previous 4 weeks before the Dowlers released their statement, so literally as the trial was ongoing, the Met Police approached Surrey Police to take formal statements from everyone involved in the original inquiry, who were concerned about how journalists had not only intercepted and listened to voicemails on Millie's phone, but even deleted them in the weeks after she disappeared. Turns out it was standard practice in the News of the World's newsroom when there was a countrywide story of media sensation to hire PIs to get them a story. And yes, it was illegal, but no one seemed to care about that. The Guardian writes in a July 2011 article by Nick Davies and Amelia Hill that Hampshire PI Steve Whitmore was to obtain home addresses and ex-directory phone numbers for any families named Dowler in the Walton area. Now, the addresses were found legally on the electoral register, but the phone numbers had to be blagged illegally from British Telecom's confidential records by an associate of this PI. One of the phone numbers turned out to be the correct one, attributed to Millie's phone. The News of the World, with the help of PI Glenn Mulcair, then started illegally intercepting messages on Millie's phone. According to The Guardian, as Millie's friends and family called and left messages for Millie, begging her to get in touch, the News of the World listened and recorded everything. But then the mailbox filled up and no new messages could come in. So the News of the World deleted the earlier messages to allow space for new ones, for new stories. What did this mean? Well, it meant that when friends and family called Millie again and found that her mailbox was suddenly no longer full, they concluded that she must be alive and deleting her own messages. Maybe she had run away. It was false hope followed by agony when they found out that wasn't the case. I mean, in their search, the Dowlers even organised an exclusive interview with the News of the World, none the wiser as to what was going on, in which they talked about this hope they now had. And of course, the deleting could have messed with the investigation. Important evidence could have been lost. Sometimes abductors call and leave voicemails to cover their own tracks. Anyone who destroys evidence is interfering with the investigation. But what is possibly the most shocking thing about this is that the paper didn't even really try to hide what they were doing. They wrote articles about the information they were finding out from the voicemails. I mean, that was the entire reason they were doing it. I mean, they wrote a story on the 14th of April 2002 about a recruitment agency who called Millie 6 days after she disappeared and left a voicemail about a job interview that was coming up. Now, this would turn out to be a case of just a wrong number, but the News of the World didn't believe this. They tried to ruin the recruitment agency's reputation by saying they were hiring underage girls and that Millie was still alive and being hidden by the recruitment agency in Telford. I mean, they even went to the police about this and told them about the messages. It defies belief that it could be so brazen, but it really was. Turns out that the Surrey Police did indeed know about what was going on very early on, but their main focus was finding Millie and apparently nothing else. They didn't really have the manpower, I guess, to follow through on the misconduct of the paper as well as the investigation. They actually ended up inviting the newspaper staff for a meeting to discuss the case. I don't really know why, maybe they thought if they could give actual information, maybe they'd leave the phone alone. It's important to remember that the tabloids in this time, the tabloids even now, today, were absolutely untouchable. They could do what they wanted with no repercussions. They were controlled by Rupert Murdoch. In September 2011, the Dowler family were offered £3 million in personal damages by News International, who owned News of the World, and that included a personal donation to a charity by Rupert Murdoch of the family's choosing. So that was £2 million to the family themselves. Murdoch said that he made the donation to underscore his regret for the abhorrent hacking, and this followed the News of the World being shut down for good because of the scandal. The Dowlers released a statement saying, "Nothing that has been agreed will ever bring back Millie or undo the traumas of her disappearance and the horrendous murder trial earlier this year." The only way that fitting tribute could be agreed was to ensure that a very substantial donation to charity was made in Millie's memory. We hope that projects be undertaken so that some good can come from this. The fact that this family continued to fight on is just incredible to me. But it does seem following the scandal, they did manage to have a few years of relative peace as you can get. That is until 2015, when Levi Belfield finally confessed after bragging to fellow prison inmates about what he'd done to Millie, and this led to a new investigation being launched into whether or not he actually had an accomplice. A man in his 40s was arrested on the back of this, but he was released without charge because there just wasn't any evidence. This news was shared with the Dowlers in mid-2015, but wasn't actually released to the public until early 2016 because of the new police investigation into the accomplice. It had to be released by the family now because one of the inmates Belfield confessed to was leaving prison, and it was very likely he was going to go to the press anyway. Belfield's confession came in the midst of this new investigation, in which for the very first time he detailed the events of that day, saying that he would confess to what happened to Millie, but he made it clear that he would only speak to female officers. Without a doubt, it was just another power play from him. He then provided a harrowing account of Millie's last hours, and it was more distressing than anyone could have imagined. In all honesty, I don't want to detail the brutality that Millie dealt with in the final hours of her life, and I don't think any of you want to hear it either. I wish I hadn't read it. So I'm just going to share a loose timeline of events. Belfield did indeed abduct her and take her into the Collingwood Place flat. He then took her to his mother's house, where I can only assume his mother wasn't in, and then he took her to another location, which I still don't think he shared. The next day, he strangled her. Millie was essentially tortured for 14 hours before her death. Dowlers ended their public statement about this by saying, "Now we know the final hours of Millie's life, perhaps her soul, at long last, can finally rest in peace. The general public have always played a huge part in supporting us, for which we are eternally grateful and thankful. We believe they should know what Belfield did to our beautiful daughter and sister, Millie." 14 years after Millie disappeared, and finally there was some semblance of closure and answer. Even though Belfield had been found guilty many years beforehand, he wasn't talking, but now they know what happened to her, for better or for worse. And from the sounds of it, that is what the Dowlers wanted. They just wanted an admission of guilt. It's truly incredible to me that after 14 years, 15 years, even now, they are still able to fight forward and sort of advocate for their daughter, because I can imagine so many families would just fall apart, and who can blame them? But the Dowlers, they just keep pushing forward. It is truly incredible, because I don't think I could do that. Even to this day, Belfield crops up in the media far more often than anyone would like. He is a depraved individual who apparently now enjoys confessing to crimes. I do think it's generally accepted that he has committed many more crimes than he's been charged for. I don't think the investigation has even scratched the surface of the things this man has done. In June 1980, 14-year-old Patsy Morris found strangled on Hounslow Heath.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page, and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Belfield was Patsy's childhood boyfriend, and they attended the same school, and he was apparently fascinated by her murder. He would have been just 12 years old at the time, which was just 1 year before his first actual criminal conviction. Belfield did not attend school on the day of Patsy's murder, and he is highly considered to be a possible suspect in her death. He was 12 years old. In 1990, 51-year-old Judith Gold was murdered via blunt force trauma with multiple blows to the face with an unidentified weapon. The attack matches Belfield's MO and is also linked to around 20 other attacks on women in London between 1990 and 2004. Following Belfield's conviction, Judith's murder file was reopened, and just last year he is said to have confessed to her murder, but I would take it with a pinch of salt. It seems he now enjoys the attention he gets on the back of these confessions. He also confessed to the murders of mother and daughter Lynn and Megan Russell, who were attacked with a claw hammer as they walked down a country lane. He wrote a 4-page confession apparently, but it's said that he's kind of treated his admission as a game. He's been obsessed with this murder since 2017 in prison. It was eventually announced that Belfield isn't thought to have had anything to do with this, and besides, Michael Stone is already in prison for the murder, although apparently there is question around Stone's guilt. Kent police have already said they have no intention of reinvestigating the murders, and that seems to be that. In general, I say I am against the death penalty, but a monster like Belfield and knowing the things he's done really does make me question that. Thank you so much for choosing to spend this time, this hour with me, with Millie, with the Dowler family, and learning about her story. Belfield is not the interesting one in this case. He is just a depraved, disgusting individual who is going to rot in prison. He's going to remain there until the day he dies. Millie Dowler was a beautiful, enigmatic, charismatic teenage girl who could have gone on to do so many things with her life. Life would be so much better if nobody knew the name Millie Dowler apart from the ones who loved her, her family, her friends. But here we are today telling this story. I shouldn't be here telling this story, but I am. Again, thank you for tuning in, and I'll see you. Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. In the next one. Bye, guys.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.